This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. We're into the final hour of the programme. It's 4 minutes past 11 o'clock. Earlier we spoke to Councillor Thomas Sean Devine of the 100% Redress Party, who moved a motion of no confidence in Housing Minister Dara O'Brien at the plenary meeting of Donegal County Council in Lifford last evening. As we said at the time, a counter-motion was proposed by Councillor Kieran Brogan of Fianna Fáil. That counter-motion suggested that the vote on a vote of confidence be deferred until after Minister O'Brien visits Donegal, which is expected to do in the coming weeks. That counter-motion fell. It was defeated by 18 votes to 11, and the original motion was passed. Now we're joined on the line by Councillor Kieran Brogan, who is the Deputy Mayor of Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. Kieran, good morning.
Good morning, Donald.
Councillor Kieran Brogan, why did you feel it necessary yesterday to move that counter-motion?
Well, I think in fairness, we all know that the new defective block scheme is only up and running now for over a year. And that scheme wouldn't be reviewed until after a year. And we all know that there's some challenges in the scheme that we need to try and improve. And I'm led to believe, although I'm not a member on it, that there was a very constructive and positive defective concrete block meeting recently. And the members of that group, I suppose, address some of the concerns that they have, and I think moving forward together, it was suggested that the minister would be coming to the county. I think we were informed that he would be coming to the county soon, and that we would maybe together and put together the challenges that we've seen in the system and try and overcome them hurdles together. And I think, you know, what happened here yesterday was, you know, a motion of no confidence in the minister. I think, you know, it's all right. And it's grand, and I said yesterday it may or may not get a headline, but it won't achieve anything, and it's probably somewhat misleading for people to think that we as a council can change national legislation or decisions like this, because a motion of no confidence or decision on a minister can only be taken in the National Parliament and Leinster House in Dublin. We as a council have, through the defective block scheme, worked together over the years. There's a cross-party working group there that has worked very hard over the last number of years to try and address the challenges in the system and the scheme. There was an old scheme there that was 90-10, and there was a figure of 247,000. Now, that scheme was changed, and in fairness, I think, to our own Minister, Charlie McConlogue, who played a huge role in bringing about this new scheme, where it's now up to 420,000. And we know there's changes expected to that scheme soon, and that's something that hopefully can be addressed. But I think the best way of us addressing, shaping any policy going forward is to try and meet with the minister and his team, because I've always seen the role of a public representative.
But the point that was made yesterday that Minister Dara O'Brien hasn't met, Minister O'Brien hasn't met with homeowners in the past, and he may have made visits to Donegal, but he's met with political representatives. He hasn't met with the homeowners. There is a sense among very many homeowners in the county and further afield, we're told, that Dara O'Brien isn't connecting with them, that Dara O'Brien just isn't taking on board the enormity of the situation that they find themselves in, and that's the reason it's important to make this, you know, finding of no confidence in him, to send a very clear and distinct message.
That wouldn't be accurate, because in fact the homeowners were part of the initial working group, and the elected representatives for the councillors in Donegal weren't part of it. It was the homeowners who Dara O'Brien put on that working group, and he was the person who appointed the homeowners back in the day. Donald, so I think it's important we're accurate about that. And there has been many challenges throughout the scheme in getting it to where it is today. And, you know, things about the additional money for the rent and additional money for the storage, all that would have came from the homeowners over the last number of years. And we all know that there's challenges in the scheme we need to try and improve going forward. But I think there's a genuine effort being made to improve that. And I think we're stronger together if we sit down around the table together as a collective group of elected members and our officials in the council as well, because I do know that our own people within the council, who have somewhat of a limited role of administering the service. Nevertheless, there have been $35 million paid out to date on the scheme, which is a huge amount of money. And I think they're the people who are dealing with the scheme on a daily basis. They know the challenges that are there. And I know there was a motion put forward yesterday about additional resources to try and get more information out to the hubs, which I thought was a good motion, because I think what we need to do is try and streamline where there is some hurdles and where there is some information that's not out there, and try and be as helpful as we can to as many homeowners, because at the end of the day, this is an issue that has caused a huge amount of anxiety and stress to many families. We need to try and learn from maybe some of the hurdles that people have faced to date
and trying to help them to overcome that. And the only way of us doing that will be sitting down with the minister and with his team to try and do it together. And I think everybody that I've seen working on this scheme have been trying to do the best for the homeowners. And I think we can achieve more by continuing to do that going forward. You know, you'll get a headline, surely, if no confidence and stuff like that. I don't think we'll achieve anything. And maybe it's, you know, playing a bit of politics or whatever. I think we need to take this more serious. And that's why I put down the counter motion yesterday, because hopefully when the minister does come, that we all get a chance to express the concerns we have with the scheme and how we can improve the scheme going forward. Because this is a scheme that's going to be around for a while, and it's important to try and do what we can together on this scheme going forward.
Do you have any confirmation as to when that visit will take place?
No, I haven't, and I'm sure that that will be something that will be done through your own minister, Minister McConnell-Logue, because they both sit at Cabinet together. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think we're lucky that we have a Cabinet Minister here in Donegal, and a lot of good work has been achieved.
Yeah.
And we need to continue focus on what we can do for the North West and here in Donegal. And this scheme here, I believe, wouldn't be as far advanced, only that we had the benefit of having somebody at the Cabinet table to do that.
The point was made that the Council will effectively be closed for the month of August. There won't be meetings. A lot of people will be on holiday. And maybe August isn't the best of times to be having such a meeting as this, that it would have been a lot better had the minister come at a time when all the council offices were open, when council was meeting on a regular basis, when the council was perhaps having the special housing meetings, the last of which is taking place today before the August recess, as it were. So from that point of view, a bit of dissatisfaction with the timing of this visit by Dara O'Brien. How important is it in your view that when Dara O'Brien comes, he does meet with the 100% redressed representatives, that he does meet with homeowners, that he is actually seen to be engaging directly with those affected? Because, as you say, he may well indeed have put homeowners on committees and working groups in the past, but there is a perception out there that he's not as in touch with the homeowners as others have been, and that needs to change.
Yeah, well, first of all, the council office doesn't close during August, and there doesn't be as many meetings during August, but we all know in the world we live in now today, with electronic devices and stuff, we have so many, there's so much access and people are available. I believe and I'm hopeful that those who have confidence in Dara O'Brien, that he will sit down and meet with them and meet with the executive of the council. And on occasions like this, I've almost seen people made themselves available to make a very positive presentation. And I think our director of service, who's dealing with this now over the last maybe a year or more, Michael McGarvey, has a very good grasp on the challenges there. And I think our own people can, together, sit down with the elected members and make a good positive presentation. I think we need to look at this visit to the county as a positive and to review the scheme after 12 months to see exactly how the scheme is working and to see if there is hurdles or challenges in the system, which I know there is. There's a lot of challenges, and how together we can overcome them. Because at the end of the day, our objective is to try and support homeowners in every way we can to get their homes fixed. That's our objective as a party in Fianna Fáil. That's what we've worked on for the last number of years. We've put a lot of time and effort into this scheme. We've had a lot of meetings over different times to try and overcome the challenges and the hurdles of the scheme. And as I said before, this is a very, very emotive issue, but I think together we're stronger together and not playing politics with this issue, because I think it's much too serious of an issue to be playing politics with.
Is it your belief that we will see movement from the government side in terms of amending and improving the scheme between now and a general election campaign? The all resumes in September. We know the budget's the first week in October. Ostensibly, that's to facilitate a European meeting, but the widespread perception is that that's to facilitate a general election in mid-November. If we're going to be hitting into an election campaign once we get into the early weeks of October, is anything going to be done to actually address this issue, or is it just going to become part of an election campaign and all the that goes with it?
As I said, Donal, I think this is much too serious of an issue to be playing election or politics with it. I believe this is something that's going to be around for a while. And I think if all parties are around the table together in a positive, constructive way, this is about supporting the homeowners in every way we can. And it's much too serious of an issue to just be playing games because there's an election coming up. I think we need to be showing the homeowners that we want to shape the policy towards the needs of the people. And I believe that that will happen, and that will be a gift of the minister to come down to announce exactly what he's going to do in that regard.
And you believe that is going to happen in the coming weeks?
I'd be confident it will, yeah.
Councillor Kieran Brogan. Yeah. Kieran, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. That's Councillor Kieran Brogan there, who moved that counter-motion at the County House in Liffey yesterday during that meeting, at which Councillor Thomas Sean Devine had moved the initial motion of no confidence in the Minister. And as we said when speaking to Thomas earlier, what happened was the counter-motion fell by 11 votes to 18 and the original motion then passed. Looking at some of your other comments, and indeed someone said, made the point, if 30,000 people marched in Dublin to say they had no confidence in the Minister, what makes the Redress Party think that their motion will have any significance? Another councillor says, please name all the councillors that abstained. I want to ensure I never vote again for any councillor who abstains in any vote. Bishop Casey, and we spoke about Bishop Eamon Casey earlier on and whether he should still be buried in the cathedral in the Diocese of Tuam. Caller says, Bishop Casey, what a horrible and despicable man to be buried in consecrated ground. He should be dug up and burned and scattered in a dump. Another person asks, how many people believe that Bishop Casey should be left to rest in consecrated grounds? Now, there is a difference here between someone being buried in consecrated ground and someone being buried within the crypt of the cathedral. Being buried within the crypt of the cathedral is an honour that is bestowed on former bishops and former dignitaries within the church. The question is, should someone of Bishop Casey's history, who is now, we're told, effectively viewed as a sexual predator, is the crypt of a cathedral in an honorific position suitable for such a person to be buried in? That's a question. Now, in fairness, consecrated ground is another story. There are many people with checkered pasts buried in consecrated grounds. There are many people with various convictions buried in consecrated ground. Buried in consecrated ground is a different thing, in fairness. And if that were to be debated, that could become a very wide debate indeed. Another caller says, having watched the Bishop Casey documentary last night, it makes you wonder how many other secrets the Vatican are hiding. I feel so sorry for his niece and others who have never got closure. Earlier on, a caller asks, where is Joe Biden? And then another caller suggested that Donald Trump would be the person to solve the Ukraine-Russia conflict and also the Israel-Gaza war. Well, one of our callers has responded, Joe Biden is an 81-year-old man with COVID. That's what he's been doing. As for Trump stopping the Gaza war, he's a diehard Israel supporter. He even has an illegal settlement named after him. Stunningly ill-informed. Another caller says, in relation to speed limits that we discussed earlier, fit the council better to bring the roads up to standard, but down the speed limits just because they can't do what they're supposed to. There are too many chiefs in Iford. Now, as I did say, and we discussed this briefly earlier, there was a presentation at Donegal County Council yesterday. There is a draft document which proposes a number of changes to speed limit bylaws across Donegal, one of those changes being in certain areas, limits being reduced from 80 kilometres an hour to 60 kilometres an hour. Now, there is a draft document was produced at that meeting, and that's going to go out to public consultation. It'll be published and go to consultation in the coming days. What we've done is we've taken that document as it was presented to council yesterday, and we've put that document up on our website. So if you want to go into the news section of the Highland Radio website, you can look at that document. Now, it's not a uniform 60 kilometres an hour across the board. It's in very specific circumstances, and there are some very precisely worded suggestions in that document, which you could not really summarise for a news story or on a programme like this, because it's incredibly detailed. So what I would suggest is go on to our news website. You'll see that document there. Have a look at the document, read through it, and see what they are proposing. Another caller says, can you raise the question with Donegal County Council why their e-parking app is down so often? It is unreliable. I've only used the e-parking app on a handful of occasions, and it did work for me, but certainly it's a point that we'll raise. We were talking about the Polestar earlier with Sergeant Eunan Walsh during the Garda community slot, and caller says the Polestar is a nightmare for visitors or strangers to the town. I'm local and I'd go out of my way to avoid it if I could. Now, I think in fairness, I would have to say it is awkward having lights in the middle of the roundabout, and that is strange. And I do have to say it's almost, when you have lights on a roundabout, what you're effectively doing is, and I find I'm going onto the roundabout because my light is green. If I'm coming, say, from the four lane and I'm going to turn up the Remelton Road, which is what I would do quite frequently if I'm coming back from Lifford or wherever. And I found this yesterday, actually, even coming back from Lifford, about 20 past six or thereabouts yesterday evening. So I'm approaching the Polestar roundabout, and I'm taking the third exit off the roundabout to go over by the Remelton Road. as I'm going onto the roundabout, because my light is green, I can see cars coming from the Remelton Road and from the Port Road Town Centre side coming on my right. And my instinct is to stop, because when you're going onto a roundabout, if there's traffic coming from your right, you stop and you don't go onto the roundabout. Now, my brain knows that those cars are coming around the roundabout and they are going to stop because there are lights there. But the brain sort of sees the cars coming around the roundabout, and it just feels strange to be driving onto a roundabout when you can still see cars approaching you from the right. It just sort of feels wrong, even though my brain knows there is a stop, there is a light there that's going to stop those cars. It is, but I find I was nervous about it for the first week or two, to be honest. And I think most people were, but I'm used to it, and I've spoken to various people who were very iffy about it at the start, but now they're at peace with it. But it's an obvious ongoing discussion to be had, and there will be lots of discussions about the Polestar over the coming weeks, months, and I suspect, let's face it, years. It's 11:19, time for a short break, back after these. Now we have two guests in studio, joined by Hugh Friel of the Donegal Travellers Project and also by David Carpacci, who is a Roma Health Community Worker in Donegal. You're both very welcome indeed.
Thank you. Nice.
And David, you're welcome. Thank as well. You. Pleasure. A short documentary film, Samron, is to be shown on this coming Thursday at 12 noon at the Regional Cultural Centre on the Port Road in Letterkenny. It's a film that depicts the Roma community in Ireland with a focus of the on those living in Donegal. David, turning to you first, as a member of the Roma community and a health community worker within that community, important from your point of view that story is told?
It is important because there was never a documentary done in Ireland about our community.
And in terms of Roma, people will be aware of Roma, and the immediate instinct is to say Roma. Yeah, they're travellers, but there is a uniqueness to your community, and there are differences in your community, and there is a specific identity within your community that you want to see preserved.
There is. You can get Pentecostal Roma, you can get Polish Roma, you can get Ukrainian Roma, you can get Czech Roma. It's all the same, but different traditionals.
And the Roma tradition is one that, as we say, the wider community perhaps not aware of, but important to yourself, and good that this story is being told and being told to a wider audience.
It is very important because there is our community just talk about the challenges and the discrimination they face day by day.
Hugh, as a member of Donegal Travellers Project, you've been working with David and others for years. I mean, put this film into context for us. I mean, what can people expect if they go to see it?
I think it's a new, exciting, historical documentary in terms of what we've established. Emir Heaney led out with David, myself, Siobhan McLaughlin as the manager, initiated this idea around the Roma documentary, and to document the kind of the culture and aspects of and history of the Roma community living in Donegal. And we've done, you know, Katie McLaughlin's leading out has been contracted, and her and the team in terms of the documentary. And it's been quite exciting and quite a development in terms of us as Donegal Travellers Project and the Roma Project to facilitate and go out and feel warm and welcomed by the Roma community. And to kind of document that on a film aspect has been quite an eye-opener in relation to the diversity within the Roma community, because we have different contents of the documentary in terms of the Pentecostal church and the singing, the wealth of culture, singing aspects of culture, family, bonding, support mechanism within the Roma community is astonishing and very lovely. And as a member of the travel community myself, we travelled and we were very nomadic, and we historically, you know, have been subjected, I suppose, to the legislation to kind of eradicate our culture. And sometimes I looked around upon the Roma community and gives me hope and courage and kind of inspiration that the Roma community and Letterkenny and throughout the County Sligo and Leitrim Donegal host kind of cultural events within limited areas of spaces of their housing estates or their rented properties, of having small barbecues or dancing or singing. And yeah, it's really a celebratory to see. But this documentary, I think, is the first of its kind in Ireland. I haven't seen any other documentaries in relation to it, the Roma community. So it's brilliant to see that we have documented, and David has facilitated all the translation in relation to Ukraine Roma, as David outlined, Czech Roma, Polish Roma, Romanian Roma. So we have a kind of a big diversity of the EU contents of Roma. Because people see Travellers as one homogenous group, they see Roma as one homogenous group, but that's not who we are or what we're about. So that the documentary kind of celebrates this, and there's also a photo exhibition, the first of its kind too as well, that we're showing on the day.
And David, it's obvious from what he was saying there that, and you said it yourself, there's Polish Roma, there's Romanian Roma, Czech Roma, Ukrainian Roma. And from that point of view, then, the links with Eastern Europe are still there. And I'm sure that's reflected in the music, that's reflected in the culture, that's reflected in the stories.
Yeah, that's true. Every culture is nearly similar, but like different traditions.
And in terms of the music, is it music that would be influenced by Eastern European chants, Eastern European melodies, as much as Irish traditional music?
Yeah.
And so we talk about fusion, and sometimes you can get a fusion of an Irish musician playing with a musician from another culture, and it can come up with something beautiful and something very different. And it would be very interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing this, because one of the things I'm looking forward to is hearing the music, because I suspect... I mean, you know, the music of Eastern Europe, the music of those countries is going to be different to music here. But I suspect it's not just going to be Ukrainian music. It's going to be Ukrainian music with a hint of Ireland in it as well. And it's going to be something that's uniquely yours.
Yeah, the music would be similar, but it's different dialects.
Mm.
Even when you're talking Ukrainian Roma, it'd be the same but different dialects on it.
Yeah. And would some of the community still speak in those native language? Would they be speaking Ukrainian, speaking the Eastern European language? And I'm sure two words come across even into speaking English. Your own word comes, your own words come in, your own turns of phrase come in, your own way of speaking comes in, and you know that's going to be important to you as well as part of a culture to preserve.
Yeah, it is important because nearly everyone talks Romani. That's how I get on with my community, and especially the Czech community, the Polish community,
and that Romani would be, you know, all Roma would speak it, but I'm sure there's going to be different emphases, different accents, different, and that I'm sure is going to not create problems, but there's going to be you'd probably know if you were speaking Romani to someone, you'd probably know where they came from based on the accent, based on the inflections, based on the way you're speaking, you'd know which branch. Be it Ukrainian, be it Czech, be it Polish.
Yeah, it is, because when we're doing visiting, the first question I ask them is San Rom, and the answer they give us back is Sam Rom. That means we are Roma.
Yeah.
So from then, I know how to translate. And
so Sam Rom is, are you Roma? Sam Rom is, we are Roma.
Yeah.
And I should have asked that at the very start.
Actually, given that's the title of the film. The documentary.
Absolutely.
And I suppose from our perspective as well, Donegal County Council, Creative Ireland, give us the funding, you know, in relation to the documentary. So I have to thank Donegal County Council and Creative Ireland for engaging and supporting this documentary as well, and what we're trying to establish, I suppose, in terms of getting the voices of the Roma community out there.
Yeah.
In a very positive way, Greg, because that's what we're trying to achieve as well. And it's in the Airgill Arts Festival for the week as well. But if anybody wants to come along, you have to, I suppose, book with us, because we have initially a number of people coming. So Emer Heaney, is her email address is emerheaneydtp23@gmail.com, if anybody wants to come. So that's emerheaneydtp23@gmail.com. So there are RSVP to her. Yeah. Because we have a number of people coming, we have limited seats in relation to it as well. But it's going to be a very historic day for us as well at the project, as I said, because we want to celebrate the culture and identity of the Roma community. It's never been done before in Donegal or any other parts of Ireland. So it's brilliant to see that we've done this in conjunction, and the Roma community has been at the sole heart of this.
Yeah.
David has been through, you know, all the translation, the visits with the families, and the trust and the respect that you get from the Roma community in relation to that is unbelievable.
And David, it's very important too, I take it, that you are involved in making this film. This isn't somebody coming in, making a film, going away, and then presenting the film as something separate from you. You're involved in this from the off. This is your story, and you're a key part of telling that story. It isn't somebody else's interpretation of the story. It is yours.
Yeah, that's right. That is, because we done a lot of visits, especially we got more trust of my own community, because I was there, so...
And that meant that the stories that came across are genuine. They people were opened up in a way because you were there, that they mightn't have opened up if it was me or it was a filmmaker they didn't know.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
It's going to be an interesting film. I look forward to seeing it, and hopefully I will over the course of the coming days. I'll be working on Thursday, so I can't be there, but I'm hoping to see it. David, thank you very much indeed. David Carpacci, who's a Roma health community worker in Donegal, Leitrim, Sligo, and Hugh Donegal Travellers Project, no stranger to this programme.
No.
you're both very welcome indeed, and thank you very much indeed for telling the story. And just repeat that email address if people do want to go on Thursday. Hugh,
yeah,
repeat
your address again. Eimear Heaney, which is eimearheaneydtp23@gmail.com. So it's Eimear Heaney, DTP23@gmail.com.
Hugh, David, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Donald, thank you.
This is an afternoon show on Highland Radio. Now, a very important issue to discuss, and we're going to Zoom to do it, because we're being warned of a hidden pandemic of online sexual abuse, with the Internet Watch Foundation saying it's seen a spike in self-generated child abuse images where a young person is encouraged by somebody online to take explicit photos. Joined by Dan Sexton, who's Chief Technology Officer with the Internet Watch Foundation. Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Dan, good to talk to you. Dan, how big an issue is this, that people, and young people in particular, are themselves actually taking explicit photographs because they're being encouraged to do so?
So in our work at IWF, is priority is to find, assess and remove images and videos of child sexual abuse that we find on the internet. And predominantly for the last few years, the majority of that content has been images of the children without any visible third party in the room that appear to be very much, whether they've been voluntary or coerced in some manner, but they've been taken on camera-enabled internet devices and circulated on the internet. So the majority of content we find now circulated is what we've termed as self-generated, but very much as children have been coerced or otherwise voluntarily creating sexual imagery of themselves that is then distributed and circulated around. So it is the main issue that we've seen.
So does this then suggest that there are predators who are actually befriending these children online, they're talking to them on webcams, or is it something even being done through AI, or what is happening in terms of the way they're being coerced into doing so?
So both of those have been we've seen evidence of both of those in the imagery that we have assessed. Both the evidence of grooming, we've seen that, we realised that. I think there is the systems and platforms that children are using are just not designed with that safety in mind. And we're seeing that with things like rise in sextortion. So actually, with sextortion, you've got organized criminals targeting children and teenagers to extort them, fool them into creating sexual imagery, which they then use to blackmail them. And the fact that that's happening, and these are not, in this case, this is a new kind of threat actor. It's not people with sexual interest in children. These are criminals that are doing it for money. So they're seeing them as vulnerable. They're actually diverting criminal resources because they know it's easy to get that content out, easy to shame those children into then supplying money. The AI is a new way of doing this, a new eventuality and a new abuse of technology we've seen, which is only making our job even harder.
Are we getting to the point where the capability of AI will be such that a picture can be taken of a child, and that picture can be digitally, and both in terms of a picture and a video, it can be digitally manipulated to such an extent that it can make films using AI-generated scenarios and the face of the child superimposed onto other situations, which we won't talk about the detail of, but that AI can actually get to the point where it can take a face from a photograph and use that face for disgusting images and videos.
I'm very sorry to say, we were already at that point. Whatever you're seeing in the mainstream, so use of technology to do other things, legitimate things, normal things, other stuff you see on the internet, generative AI used for creation of imagery, with videos, you're seeing large language models and chatbots. What we see in the darkest places of the internet is the same technology or the same types of technology being used for nefarious purposes. In this case, to create images and videos of children being sexually abused. So it is already here and it is already happening.
And the technology to do that is, presumably, given the way any trend in technology goes, that's going to become more and more ubiquitous, more and more affordable, and more widespreadly used as we go into the future.
That has absolutely been the trend for the last year or so since we first saw signs of AI-generated child sexual abuse. The realism has increased. The severity has increased. Partially, this is the technology itself is getting better, but partially, actually, the people who are using the technology are getting better at using it. Whether that continues on the same sort of linear trend we've seen with AI in general, and there are some that are saying that maybe this isn't, you know, we are plateauing there. Whatever is happening in mainstream, we can infer that the same sort of trends will happen in criminal use of this. But at the moment, yes, it is getting, there's more of it, and it's getting worse, and it's getting more realistic.
Talk to me about the job you do, because you, as I understand it, effectively go into those dark recesses of the dark web. You go to those places where the rest of us wouldn't dare venture and wouldn't know how to venture into in most cases. And you have got to, I suspect, sit through and watch an awful lot of very, very unpleasant stuff indeed in there.
So our primary focus is a safer internet for all, an internet that's free of child sexual abuse videos and images. And most of our work is actually on the open web, the normal places that anyone could get to through a web browser, because both we're trying to protect those victims to stop their abuse being circulated, to stop them being re-victimized by their distribution of their, of that content, but also protect the public. Nobody, we don't want anyone to have to stumble across this content. We don't want it being circulated anywhere. However, what we've had to do with the AI, once we started seeing examples of AI-generated abuse on the open web, our analysts went into these dark web spaces where we know offenders and communities are distributing content, discussing content, really to give us some insights as to what might happen on the open web and how bad is that problem. And so the reports that we've recently published were really a deep dive into what we're seeing in these dedicated communities. My big concern is that what we're seeing there in those dark web spaces is going to start to come out of those dark web spaces and into the mainstream internet. And that's when other people can start to go and see it. It's going to start to get into everybody's daily lives. And that's something we really want to stop.
Is enough being done by the tech mega companies of this world, the Googles, the Apples, the Microsofts, to prevent these images being shown and these videos being shown on the open web? Because, you know, if that does make it out there, people may stumble on it, as you say, and, you know, that is something we do want to avoid at all costs. So, I mean, is there more needs to be done to perhaps recognize these AI digitally changed videos and images, to recognize the digital footprint or digital fingerprint as such? I'm not totally up to date with the language, but can these files be identified by the ISPs, by the internet providers, by the multimedia companies, by the social media companies, to identify and get rid of them?
Well, the good news is yes. Many of the solutions, once you've found the content, and this is what a big part of our work is, to find these images, to assess them, if they are illegal, to add them into lists, to record the URLs they're hosted on, to the digital fingerprints of the imagery itself, we solved the problem of identifying, detecting known content and blocking it more than 10 years ago. The solutions are robust, scalable, efficient. So that is a solved problem. The issue is it's just not widely used. It's consistency. What we need is everywhere in the world, we have the capacity to block and prevent images of child sexual abuse from being circulated. They just need to do it. And at the moment, it's largely voluntary. So we need consistency and we need measures. And so we're really, really very pleased to see, especially in the UK particularly, the Online Safety Act coming through and saying, this is possible and everyone needs to do it. And it's the baseline. It's the beginning. Once we solve that problem, The next is, how do you prevent the content being created? How do you look, find, detect content that no one's seen before and flag that? So the whole ecosystem is a solvable problem. It is something there is something we can do. And that's really our specialism. We just need all of the tech companies, all the legislators, all the governments to come together and agree how best to do it. So it is solvable. And I'm optimistic that we will be able to have a safer internet if everyone does get together and apply the select technical solutions and policy changes they need to.
We've spoken about how AI can be used to generate these images and facilitate them. Can AI be repurposed from your point of view to track them down, rather than having your volunteers and your analysts looking at sites and perhaps having to trawl through a couple of hundred sites in an evening? Can an AI program be drawn up and purposed to actually search thousands of sites over the course of an evening, identify these images, identify these files, and flag them?
It can, and there's been some really positive examples of both of those things, of very targeted use of AI, which will better tell you this looks like an image of child sexual abuse. And the key is, it is saying it looks like that. And because it looks like that, please have a human reviewer needs to check this, confirm this, and make that authoritative call. But yes, I think that's AI is a key component to stop the spread and identify new victims and safeguard new victims on the internet.
Last year, you found 275,000 sites, 92% of them contained what you described as X-rated selfies. That is a scary figure.
It is, and I don't want everyone to think that it feels to me this is the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. There is so much content out there. We're really restricted on how many staff we have looking for it, how efficient we are at getting it. If we were 10 times the size we are, I fear that we would find 10 times the amount of content out there. And again, part of that is some of that imagery that we're finding is the same images that we've already found. Some of these are victims that were abused decades ago. They're grown up survivors and their content is still being distributed. And you can only imagine how frustrating that is for our analysts to go and see the same children every day on the same on different sites again. Again, that's a solved problem. We shouldn't be able to, we should have solved that and removed all of that. And those survivors should feel safe knowing that their content is no longer being distributed.
Well, as the technology changes to facilitate this happening, hopefully the technology will also continue to develop to allow it to be prevented. In the meantime, Dan Sexton, thanks very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Dan Sexton, their Chief Technology Officer with the Internet Watch Foundation. Thank you indeed, Dan. Good morning. Another burst in Manor Cunningham. Does anybody know when this will be fixed? Also, no water yesterday. Councillor says, is Councillor Brogan for real? The councillors were nowhere to be seen or heard when Michael started. It was Paddy Diver got this problem highlighted. As for our local TD, he can't even speak in our local radio station. Another caller said, if county councillor said Micah, it would be a different story. A number do, it does have to be said. Any word on when the inquiry into planning in Donegal will be made public? Last time Dara O'Brien was on Highland, he said it was on his desk, but he hadn't got around to reading it. Regarding your two interviews today, a caller says, I would have to agree with Councillor Thomas Devine from the Redress Party. We all saw that where there is a will, there is a way in the situation of the people from Ukraine. The government was able to source accommodation for thousands in a very short space of time. Now, I have no issue with assisting the people of Ukraine, but the government could sort out the situation so quickly because they had the will to do it. Why is there a lack of urgency to source temporary accommodation, such as modular homes, for those who are living with the plight of unsafe houses? Where is the urgency to act? I believe the motion of no confidence had to be proposed to send out the strong message that the minister is not prioritising this issue as it should be prioritised. So says a caller, and there's more on that we may get to in a few moments. But before we do, another caller says, Garthy, you're doing a great job, but it's only the tip of the iceberg. Courts are too lenient with dealers there in every village in the county. I presume that is to do with drugs. Now, we're going to go to line one because we're joined by Susan Gray, the founder of PARC, Promoting Awareness, Responsibility and Care on the Roads. Susan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald. Thanks for asking me on.
It's our pleasure as always. Now, we will have heard from Michaela on the headlines at 11 that a loophole that allowed learner drivers stay on the road without ever taking a driving test is to be closed. And it seems to me, Susan, that the very first time we spoke many, many years ago, that was an issue that you were highlighting even way back then.
Yeah, as far back as 2013, Donald. Can you believe that?
It's
11 years ago, we started asking for this loophole to be closed, and the Road Safety Authority put a provision in their strategy then to close it by 2014. And here we are in 2024, And the Minister for Transport, Eamon Ryan's office, contacted us on Friday to say that he has now, to address the issue of learner drivers continually renewing a learner permit without ever sitting a driving test, a new policy has been approved by the Minister for Transport and conveyed to the Road Safety Authority. After the third learner permit, the new policy will require that a learner actually sit a driving test before they're eligible for an additional permit. Now that is welcome. We've been told it often, but we never really got it in writing that it's progressed to this level. So we're delighted to get that. Now it's totally down to the Road Safety Authority, who he said is working on an implementation plan for the new policy and will submit its proposals to this department shortly. So that phased introduction of the new policy will begin in 2024. Now, it rests with the Road Safety Authority, so we're not over the hill yet, Donald.
Yeah.
But it had to start with the minister. This is a ministerial order now, so the Road Safety Authority, we would think, must get their act together now.
Now, it's your understanding, I take it, that this will not need legislation. This is just going to take, as you said, directives and arrangements being made by the Road Safety Authority to implement this. It will not require legislation at all, because if it were to require legislation, the chances are it wouldn't get through before the next general election and would thereby fall by the wayside.
No, the minister's reply said implementation of the new policy will require changes to ICT systems within the Road Safety Authority and a certain amount of manual processing.
So the actual legal framework and legal basis to do this has been there all along?
It would appear to be, Donal, and the delay, we were told by the Road Safety Authority for years, was that they didn't have enough testers and they were crying out for them. Will the minister give them all the additional testers they needed last year to bring down the waiting time for a learner to get a driving test application? So
Is it your hope that the RSA would have anticipated this and they would have ideas already in place that they can come up with a policy fairly quickly? Because the last thing we want to see is this to be dragged on for months and months and months while people sit down and try and formulate a policy. It's utterly predictable that this day was going to come, and hopefully they will have had some work already done to actually speed up this process.
Well, they've been planning to close it since 2013, Donal, with a completion date of 2014.
Yeah.
And then that went on to 2016. And then it went on to 2018. So, of course, they must have it ready to go after 11 years of proposals and planning and submissions to the Transport Minister. There's no excuse now. This totally lies now the Road Safety Authority. If this isn't implemented, it's because they haven't done their bit of work to ensure that it can be started ASAP.
Do you have confidence after being told it would be done all those previous years, do you have confidence that this time it's different?
Well, our minister's come on board now and actually put it in writing. And he has approved a new policy. We never had that before.
Yeah.
That's where it needed to start. We never got it that far before. We just got promise from the Road Safety Authority. And they would always say that they sent proposals to the current minister and there it ended. Well, no, it hasn't ended now. The minister has signed off on it and he's informed RSA. And any things now that are left to do are totally items that the Road Safety Authority has to do. There are single licensing authority in Ireland since 2013 in charge of permits and driving licenses.
And I presume you'll be making contact with the RSA yourself to ask what level of priority has been given to this.
Oh, we've already done that, Donald, and we asked for a copy of their latest proposals of the implementation plan that they're putting in place, that they're going to send to our transport minister now. We've been told time and time again it's on its way. So we'll contact them. Their director was on annual leave 2 weeks ago, and they had to wait till he came back to get it signed off. And so that 2 weeks is up now. So we'll just keep at it, because, and we would beg the media not to lose hold of this issue, to keep following it. We will keep asking the questions. We will keep reporting to the media, because it's only the media that will get this totally across the line, Donald, without a doubt.
Susan, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. And it's an important one, obviously. As you said, it's one we've discussed before. And we will indeed be keeping a very close eye on this one. For the moment, Susan Gray of Park, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Donald.
Okay, Susan, you take care. Now, Susan there, coming very close to the end of the Mental News Show, just one or two comments before we go. Connor says, you spoke there of a community who'd like to hear the old air raid siren. I have five such sirens. I'm just a collector. If any community wanted to put one to good use, I'd give them one. Another caller says, complaints came into the council in 2012, and 12 years later, what is Kieran Brogan's response to the latest ditch report? And going to finish on this comment, caller says, I met with one of the defective concrete facilitators in the last number of weeks about getting on the enhanced scheme. While they were helpful and friendly, I did note how they frame things, such as implying there is a lot of scaremongering on radio and even with the redress group, and that much of it is untrue. I disagreed with them. They implied that while not perfect, the current scheme people could get a nearly new home with little personal expense. I said I found myself in disagreement with that. They said about 80% of people that are on the scheme are happy with it, and that there's a myth about those in Dublin affected by mica pyrite that they got 100%, but this isn't true. Apparently they had other costs to pay. I think some of these facilitators have their narrative and try to dismiss anything that deviates from it. I came away from the meeting not very satisfied or encouraged. They referenced how some people expect to get huge houses rebuilt or demolished, which isn't realistic, and are expecting expensive items to be included in the scheme. I said if you pay for something fair and square, you should be entitled to full recompense, if not up to standard. People need to be aware that these facilitators are working for the government and not for you. And thank you, caller, for your comment. And that's it for the 9th of Noon Show. John Breslin's up next around the Northwest. Thank you to Shannon and to Caroline for taking your calls. Caroline produced and held my hand as always. Thanks to all our contributors to the programme. Most importantly, thank you to you for your contributions and to you for listening. I'm Donald Kavanagh. See you again tomorrow. Until then, have a very good day.